Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
So I'm staying in my armchair. Go on without me if you must. So many shows on Netflix. And even more on Hulu Plus. Nonstop solid entertainment. Till my body turns to dust. TV is awesome!
Here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to the Christmas special of TV Good Sleep Bad. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, I'm from the Dexter Duty Help. And joining me, of course, is my partner in crime and co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Hello.
If you haven't guessed already, this is going to be something of a, well, I would say it's going to be something of a surreal episode, but that seems to always be the case whenever we do these Christmas episodes. It's either surreal or hyper-offensive or somewhere between the two.
That's just the Star Wars Christmas special.
Yes. I don't know. I have a feeling, though, with one of our selections this evening, well, if not both of our selections this evening, we may have managed to top the weirdness of the holiday special last year. So, I mean, if you've obviously not seen in the title already, we are going to be looking at the community episode, Abed's Uncontrollable Christmas, as well as checking out the Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special as well. But as always, we are going to start the show by asking what you've been watching. I mean, it's obviously not been too much of a gap between recording our previous episode and this one. So, I mean, has there been anything that sort of stood out to you at all in that time, Lackey, or is it?
Weirdly enough, I binged a Netflix show. There is a show on Netflix called Pacific Heat. And probably the best way to describe it, The most obvious way to describe it is basically an Australian version of Archer. Right. And it's got almost the exact same art style, the exact same animation style. And it's nowhere near as good as Archer. It's the characters are nowhere near the idea basically being that it's a, special forces policemen, that are various stages of competency.
Yeah.
Handling big crimes on the Gold Coast, the rich Gold Coast of, Australia. And, so they're constantly going against Asian gangsters or Russian gangsters or German gangsters or whatever. There's nowhere near the amount of character depth that Archer has. One of the things that I always marvel about Archer is for a show that looks like such a throwaway, exactly how deep that show is and how consistent that show is. This is a lot of, Pacific Heat is a lot of questionable accents. The second or third episode, even as it is the third episode, I was wondering whether I could still be a good liberal and watch the show because every episode had some sort of racially offensive stereotype in it. And the only thing I could really say in my defense was that, well, at least all the white characters were stupid and offensive as well.
Yeah.
But it doesn't ever really transcend its premise. But there are some great – about halfway through, the cast really gets this sort of perfect timing down with each other. There's this great scene about halfway through where the four of them are trying to they're trying to interrogate a guy. The lead cop Todd wants to interrogate him, wants to torture him, and he's like, the four of us, we're not going anywhere. And then the sniper Veronica says, well, I have plans tonight. And he says, well, some of us, Zach, who is basically the stupid one, says, I have to go to the gym. I says, well, at least two of us, and I think it's, I don't remember her name, but the other woman, the one who's at least female agent, who's at least moderately competent, says book club. And then Todd says, I've got all night. And I'm not doing the scene justice, but it really is, like I said, it's been getting a lot of bad reviews. I think the AV Club, the headline for its review was, what if Archer, but bad, you know, okay. But it's not high art comedy, but it's amusing. And I blew through all 13 episodes fairly quickly. And there was some stuff in there I thought was fairly funny. Other than that, I finally bowed knuckled under to peer pressure, and I've started Gotham.
Okay.
So I'm about five or six episodes into the first season, and I was really iffy until I think it was the third episode, the one where the guy goes around handcuffing people to weather balloons.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, this is going to be batshit insane. I'm in.
Yeah. It's a show, I think, as we've talked about before, it's a show, it's very Sin City-esque, and it's very much of its own world. It's doing a very unique take on the Batman world, and I think, I personally don't understand why people aren't getting behind it yet. We can have, like, umpteen seasons of the god-awful Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and anything else that Marvel TV studios want to churn out, and it's sort of like Gotham is, it feels like it's trying to do something different, at least. And I love the styling of the show. As I said, it's very Sin City-esque. The fact that these characters, no one has mobile phones, so it's got a 1950s style to it, despite being seemingly set in the present day. All the characters are all really interesting to look at. And the fact that here where the focus isn't just on Bruce becoming Batman. We obviously, the main focus is on Jim Gordon, and he's sort of like the last good cop in Gotham. And seeing how he encounters all these future main villains of the Batman roster, I mean, as it goes on, you're obviously introduced to different characters like the Joker. We see like the origins of Penguin and the Riddler, and there's other lower ranked characters like Fish Mooney, Hugo Strange, Firefly. These sort of characters are obviously introduced and given unique spins. I mean, we obviously see the young Catwoman, we see the young Poison Ivy. Poison Ivy, they actually have reworked, because when she's introduced in the early seasons, I mean, she's a young child like Catwoman, and obviously they just, for some reason, they couldn't make the character work. So when she does return, she's more like an eco-activist, which makes perfect sense for her character, especially within this world. I mean, the distribution for the show has been really screwed up here in the UK. So we got like the first three seasons on Channel 5 here, and then we got nothing. And I think there's been another two seasons over in the States. So we've now, thanks to Netflix, been able to get the next season. So I'm hoping over the Christmas break to catch up on that. But seeing how these characters evolve over the course of the season, and in particular, Gordon's partner, it's Harvey.
Harvey Bullock, played by Donald Logue.
Yeah, who, for my money, is like one of the best selling points of the show. Donald Logue is just, every scene he's in is fantastic.
See, I think at least at this point, they're really, I think, pushing the Harvey Bullock bad cop way too hard.
Yeah.
They soften up on that, but it's like at least twice an episode, it's like, yes, I know he's a bad cop. He's a dirty cop in a dirty town. Yep. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, I would advise to obviously stick with it, because, I mean, the early seasons, I mean, they're still trying to find the way to write and create these characters, and as it goes on, it does improve greatly. Certainly, the certain characters are just great from the off, like Edward Nygma.
It's at this point, I think I've said primarily the thing that keeps me, the primary draw for me are like the triumvirate of the big, the characters will go on to be the three big villains. Catwoman, who is at this point Selina, is like a 13-year-old girl. But she absolutely nailed it. I knew exactly who she was supposed to be the minute she showed up on screen.
Yeah.
That's how distinctive she was. And then Oswald Cobblepot, the Riddler, I mean the Penguin, and then Edward Nygma, the Riddler. Those two. And especially, I mean, at this point, it really kind of seems that the arc I see this show taking at this point is it's basically going to parallel Jim Gordon's kind of rise into like the one good cop in Gotham, and it's going to do the compare contrast with Cobble Oswald, you know, basically him coming to power in Gotham, and the guy who plays him, Robin Lord Taylor. My God, that guy should be in everything.
Oh yeah,
every single movie, TV show, stage play, Christmas pantomime, radio comedy skit show. My God, that guy is really the most compelling reason to watch this show. He is just so. Just whatever it is, he is a shining example of whatever it is he's supposed to be.
Mm. And I mean, he's been great even before Gotham. I mean, I caught an episode of Law and Order he was on the other day where he was playing some gay bashing thug, and again he was just fantastic. That he had bleached blonde hair, which threw me off for a minute.
Uh huh.
But yeah, he's just got so much presence. And I think in many ways, I think we may view him as being the same way that we view, I'm going to get them confused now. I want to say Gosling, who was in Drive.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I almost said, is he for Gosling or Reynolds? One of the two. I feel like him, he's going to be like one of these actors we're going to, and once he moves on from Gotham, perhaps, we're going to be like one of those actors we're just constantly want to talk about or just see in everything, as you said.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I mean, this is a show, as you said, I mean, this is all about the rise to power of these characters and how they achieve it. And the writing at times, the seasons at times, it feels like almost like the writers are like trying to cram in multiple seasons into one season. The amount uh-huh. of material that they cover over the course of a season. But, I mean, it's hard not to want to spoil things, obviously, coming up, but it's definitely a show that gets better as it goes on, as you become more familiar with these characters and they become more established in this world.
Uh-huh.
Certainly, I mean, you've got, who was in the Shield?
Chiklis?
Yes. I mean, once you get in season two, and Michael Chiklis shows up. I mean, as the commissioner, you've got all these sorts of things to look forward to. I mean, you've got Victor Freeze who comes up in season two. You get the introduction of the Joker, and which is played a lot more subtly than is not. He's not the Joker as such. He's this character who will obviously go on, which makes perfect sense because the Joker's back history. I mean, even himself, he's not sure. He's never really confirmed his true origins. When we look at things like The Killing Joke, he says himself, he's like, sure, it show his backstory is one thing one day and something completely different the next.
If I'm going to have a past, I prefer it to be multiple choices. I think the way Alan Moore phrases it.
Yeah,
that's one of the things, really. Even that sort of like caginess is whether or not you're really looking at the backstory of the Joker. It's the backstory of the Joker that fits this version of the Joker, but whether or not you're looking at the definitive version of the backstory, that's what I always thought was the genius and, of Killing Joke.
And I mean, the other key character which sort of the whole thing hinged on for me was the character of Alfred, because he's Bruce's mentor. He's his mentor. He's the father figure. He's basically what the pivot for this whole world. And Sean Pertwee does again a fantastic job.
Yeah, and I'm really glad to see that he's got like a nice, notable, regular role on a show where he can get his. I have been a fan of his since he was like, since I realized, oh, John Pertwee's son's an actor. Oh, I got to like start looking stuff up. He's in, you know? So really ever since I think, Event Horizon was, I think, the first movie I saw him in.
Same for me.
I sat through, I don't know how many pieces of crap in order to see John Pertwee in something. And thank God Dog Soldiers finally paid off. But, I really like his take on Alfred. It's very different than the traditional take on Alfred.
For myself, I mean, I saw it very much in the same vein of Michael Caine's Alfred. And Michael Caine created the character, his version of Alfred, in that Alfred's an ex-SAS guy. And that he was brought on by the Waynes because they wanted someone who could handle themselves and be able to act as a guardian to Bruce. So his SAS background pays in. And it seems to be very much the case with this vision of Alfred as well, because as it goes on, you can see he's able to handle himself. And he's, as I said, he's a mentor in many ways to Bruce. He teaches him how to hold himself, how to fight, and many of the sort of ground skills of being what Batman is in many ways. And for people who obviously get so hung up on, oh, it's different than the mythology of the comics and stuff, I always say it's like, it's the many worlds theory. I mean,
right. This
is what happens in this timeline. The same way that if we look at Ghost in the Shell, what happens in the standalone complex can go on its own path and not have to worry about how it affects the film version of Ghost in the Shell. This is just the many worlds theory you've got to view it as.
And right.
For myself, I mean, as I said before, I really love every bizarre and random twist this show has taken so far.
I'm not a purist on this either. It is a little bit weird. The one thing I have to say, it's a little bit weird because I'm such a fan of the Year One graphic novel. It is kind of weird seeing Sarah Essen as Jim's boss. But that's just I'm the guy who's been arguing that the two Doctor Who shows are not exactly the same. They take place in slightly different parallel universes, but they're not they look like they're 100%. They look like the Welsh show, you know, follows on 100% from the TV movie, but it really doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm more than happy to just explain. I'm not a continuity purist. You know, I have absolutely no problem with someone giving me a new take on the Joker or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. It's, I think this is the thing. If you're going to do something new, make it interesting. That's all I ask. I don't mind if you change things around or you want to give a new take on stuff. Just make it interesting. That's all I say. And have some sort of element of the character that you know. As I said, I don't mind that with Edward Nygma, he's starting off as a in the police bureau at Gotham, for example.
It's not a nonsensical origin for him by any stretch of the imagination. If you have someone who's kind of like this endlessly curious person who looks at everything as a puzzle or a riddle, then forensic specialist is exactly the way to go.
Yeah.
You know, that's just like when they introduce that guy as Enigma, I'm like, well, that's perfect. Of course he's going to have that kind of job. It's the perfect job if that's the kind of personality you have.
Yeah. You know? I mean, the other sort of standout, and I'm surprised I mentioned already, is that it's Ben McKenzie as Commissioner Gordon. And, I mean, Ben McKenzie first showed up in the OC, where he was, like, the moody, good-looking lead. And since then, he's really gone from strength to strength. I mean, I adored him in Southland, which is a show which I think is well worth checking out. It's a really great police procedural, and it's great to see him again doing the role of Jim Gordon. I think he's really captures the character, and especially at this stage of Gordon's life, because, I mean, he's still not been fully jaded by the world around him. He's still got this belief that he can make a difference, and I think Ben McKenzie perfectly captures that.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to obviously see what you make of it going forward. I mean, it's only one of the shows I'm renewing my Netflix subscription for, along with Mindhunters, so.
Uh-huh. But yeah, so mostly at this point, I haven't really watched a whole lot other like TV other than those two, other than the sort of off and on hot and cold season. Most recent season of Survivor closed out last night with Ben winning that, and that's not entirely surprising, but they made some changes this season. I really wish they'd stop putting new goofy twists in and just, you know, let the game be the game. But hey, after 34 seasons, what do I know? Yeah. What about you?
For myself, I mean, it's been pretty quiet on the TV front. I mean, there's been a lot of rewatches of shows. So I've been rewatching a lot of Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is just, there's just something so rewatchable about that show. And
oh yeah.
I sometimes forget how offensive at times it can be, because you get so accustomed to humor that it's only when you're watching it with, like, your wife while she's working at the computer or something, and you have, like, Frank's Little Beauties, the pageant contest, and you realize that about 90% of this episode is him talking about how he's not a pedo, and you feel kind of embarrassed of watching it.
Or the most recent season, where they have an entire musical episode where they wake up one morning and decide, it turns out that they're all black.
Oh, and when they're in the Wiz.
Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, it's but at the same time, and this is a show which somehow manages to still give us some genuinely touching moments, such as obviously when can't remember his name now. One of the characters comes out as being gay.
Oh, yeah. Mac finally came out of the closet.
And they're all, like, berating him and saying, oh, you can go back in the closet. And he's like, no, I think I'm going to stay out now. And it was just so touching for an episode based around him saying that Frank had committed a hate crime on him. Just because they could get some insurance money. And I think it's the genius of the show. And I'm really hoping it does come back soon. But, I mean, they're all, the cast are off doing other things at the minute. So
it's been renewed for two more seasons. You know, there's going to be at least two more seasons, even though, I don't know what they're doing with it. Obviously, Charlie Day is going to be in the new he's going to be in the new what's it? Pacific Rim. Yeah. Caitlin Olsen's got another show out there. I don't remember the name of it. Last I heard, Rob McElhenney was directing the Minecraft movie.
Okay.
They were doing a Minecraft movie, I think it was, and he was going to direct that. But yeah, no, that's really the thing. But really, the favorite, my favorite one in recent years, really this season, was the one where we find out why Dennis hates Valentine's Day.
It's for myself, the late season, I think just the gang go to a water park.
Oh yeah.
Just the build up to that, to the finale, is just fantastic throughout.
Just the look on McElhenney's face when he sees that the coast is clear. He's gonna sit on that water jet, by God.
but other than that, I mean, the over in Viceland, of course, because we obviously can't have an episode without me finding something to watch on that channel. We've got the return of Epically Latered, which is a documentary series focusing on different skateboarders. This series in particular has been really great for this revival series, in the fact that it's focused on a lot of skaters who have sort of been on the fringes as of late. So there's one. The first episode was on Bam Margera, who since the death of Ryan Dunn really went downhill with his health. I mean, he gained a lot of wealth, weight, and he was addicted to drugs and alcohol. And to see him now clean and getting his life back on track, I mean, he's been hiding over in Rome for about the last 14 months, basically trying to relearn his tricks. And just seeing a guy who's gone through it and then come out the other side is just so fascinating to see. And with the show, it's shot from such a detached standpoint as a director. Patrick O'Dell doesn't put himself into the frame. He'd rather just let his subjects talk and tell their own story, and he has such an eye for the archive footage as well that it just makes you want to go back and revisit a lot of the old skate films that these guys have done, in particular the episode on Spike Jones, where he talks about the films he did with like Girl, like Mouse and Yeah Right, and you see how he changed how we shoot skateboarding movies, like how he uses the camera, how he used different techniques and stuff. And I mean, just Spike Jones, any sort of profile on Spike Jones is always welcome. The fact that it's been taken from a skateboarding standpoint is just all the more fun, because obviously that's where he came from. And normally when we talk about Spike Jones, we just focus on, like, you know, being John Malkovich and adaptation and his sort of mainstream Hollywood career, and we don't look at the independent side of where he actually basically came from. But
the thing that I always associated with him, the first time I remember hearing of him, was when he started doing when he really became, well known for directing like the Beastie Boys videos.
Yeah.
And I even remember I was on a podcast with someone. And it's like, what movie from the 90s or what thing from the 90s would you most want to see a sequel to? I remember saying, I want to see a sequel to the video for Sabotage. I want to see those guys in a video and another video. But yeah, I didn't know that he directed BMX, and I didn't know that he got to start directing BMX and skateboard videos.
Yeah, I mean the in particular video Yeah Right, there's so many fun little skits that he includes in that. I mean, I like showing it just to even like non-skateboarding fans, when you have like the invisible skateboarding sequence where they've used like green screen techniques to remove the skateboard, so it looks like these guys are just floating in midair, or like the magic skateboard where it's basically a skateboard on a string, but it's cut so it goes from one skater to the next. Like one skater does his trick, he knocks it over the frame and he goes to the next guy, and it's just the flow that he does this. Or like the backward sequence in Mouse, where they basically put all these like boards in the middle of the woods and just had guys skating through the woods. Just like he just completely revitalized how skateboarding films are shot, and you can see like going forward how it influenced just how we shoot skateboarding movies. So it's fun to obviously just get back into skateboarding, because obviously, I mean, that's basically where I got my start in writing. I mean, writing for Kingpin and following skateboarders around and stuff. So it's kind of fun to get back into my roots in many ways. So,
and I love watching stuff like that. I don't watch it enough. I really should watch more, because I just like just watching that. I always, you know, it's one of those things. I always kind of did the whole extreme sports thing.
Yeah. I mean, in college, I mean, that was my group. I was a skater punk, and basically spend all my time listening to neo-punk rock records by like Black Flag and NoFX and Anti-Flag and Bad Religion and Pennywise, yeah. And generally getting into arguments and fights with the surfers down in Cornwall. So,
yeah,
it still holds a large place for me, even though I was never a particularly good skater. I just basically used to have it just to aggravate people as like a aggravating point, because people see you reach your deck and stuff and just even want to like argue with you for no apparent reason. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's basically what it's been for myself. I mean, just a lot of rewatches and stuff. But I think I'm going to renew my Netflix subscription over the Christmas period and watch Mindhunter and maybe watch Bright, which is currently being touted as one of the worst movies of the year. So,
yep.
Will Smith's career only goes strength to strength.
Oh, God, yes.
So, I don't know. Maybe we'll have my thoughts on that when we return in the new year. But on to the first of our selections this evening. I mean, like you, I mean, do you want to do Community first?
Let's lead off with Community, yeah.
Okay. This is obviously your pick for this episode. And, I mean, Community was obviously created by Dan Harmon before he went on to conquer the world with Rick and Morty.
And I want to point out the Ross brothers were also heavily involved with that before they went on to conquer the world with Captain America movies.
Yeah. But, I mean, what is it about Community that appealed to you, in particular this episode? I mean, this is a episode shot completely in stop motion, for a start.
Community always struck me as one of those things I should be watching, but never really could sit down and, like, commit to. I did watch a few episodes from the first season. You know, when I was sitting down, I had a hard time trying to figure out what to do for this Christmas special. And initially I was going to go with the initial idea was I was initially going to go with the Colbert Christmas special. And then I thought, and then I started looking at various what kind of cult shows had various had Christmas episodes. And when I was looking at Community, it's like Community is the sort of show. It's like in many ways the archetypal modern cult show. You know, it has a very rabid following, but you know didn't really do well when it was actually being aired. It's really the sort of show that we. A lot of the cult audience sees itself in. It's definitely got the dense references, the dense layers of references. That is the Dan Harmon trademark. This was the episode I ended up going with. This episode is to kind of give you a quick synopsis of the episode. The gang. Who are a group of people who have kind of sort of banded together. They go to a local community college. And you have this sort of weird sort of cross-section of people, you know, ranging from like Alison Brie and Danny Pudi and Donald Glover, who are all supposed to be playing characters in their early 20s, and then going up to like older characters, such as the ones being played by, you know, Joel McHale or, you know, even Chevy Chase. And in this particular episode, Abed, who played by Danny Pudi, Abed wakes up one day and realizes the entire world is stop motion animated. He sees the entire world is stop motion animated, which means he's got to figure out why. He decides he has to figure out what the meaning of Christmas is in order to resolve this issue. So this is it then goes from there to kind of like a parody of like the traditional stop motion animated Christmas specials, such as the Brinkin Bass ones over here, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Frosty the Snowman, etc. And also kind of like that sort of Christmas quest story. You have to go and you have to find the meaning of Christmas. And this ends up somebody I had forgotten was on this show was John Oliver, who plays the psych professor Duncan, and he hypnotizes or chrismatizes Abed, and all the gang gets in on this whole thing where you know John Oliver wants to figure out this whole thing, and it turns out that what's triggering this is it's a very personal thing. Abed's parents are divorced, and Abed's mother, this is going to be like the first on December, 9th, she always comes home and watches Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer with him. And that's not happening this year because she's got a quote unquote new family. And this is I didn't find this episode as consistently laughed out loud as I had expected it to be. But on the other hand, there's this sort of really like deep vein. I mean, the thing about Christmas is that Christmas is in many ways, it's the happiest it's supposed to be the happiest holiday, but it's often the most emotionally fraught one. And then that, a lot of things that I think people don't tend to like about themselves or a lot of things that I think people kind of, repress about themselves come out at Christmas time. It seems to be the time to really think about them and think about how all the ways your life has failed, and how you didn't live the life you thought you were going to live. You were 13 and your 13-year-old self thought you had. I'm going to go away from that line of reasoning now, but it's the other thing is that this is really Christmas is really, and I actually had to read the AV Club review of the episode to get this, but Christmas really is a very personal holiday that means something different to somebody, different things to different people. And I actually have a compare and contrast with the Pee Wee episode when we get to that. But yeah, that's kind of what I got out of the Uncontrollable Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, Community is much like Parks and Rec. It's a show that got sort of jammed somewhere in the dark recesses of the TV scheduling over here in the UK. So it never quite developed the same sort of cult following. And I think it was only really, they got picked up briefly by Netflix and then disappeared like anything good that comes onto UK Netflix. So I've only seen like parts of the first season and I've seen the odd episodes of the later season. So it's not sure that I'm super familiar with. I mean, I know the basic concept of the show. But this one, even if you know what's sort of going on, it's still a bit of a weird one to go on, mainly because it all takes place inside the head of Abed. And the fact that it even acknowledges how weird it is to itself. The characters frequently comment on how stupid things are. Certainly when we get into the sort of Wizard of Oz style Christmas world that Duncan, who is part of this delusion, is turned into the Christmas wizard, essentially transports them all to, and all the characters take on sort of like Christmas versions of themselves. So we have Jeff in the Box, Britta Bot, Balaran, Baby Doll Shirley, and Troy Soldier and Teddy Pierce. So, and I think the fact that none of them really sort of buy into this only sort of adds to the weirdness of this episode. There's no sort of grounding apart from what Abed is telling you is supposed to be happening in this episode, which certainly gives it an interesting edge. And there's times where I just felt absolutely confused as to what was supposed to be going on in this episode, even though it does kind of pay off at the end when they all decide to sort of team up and take on Duncan.
Shoot him with his with their Christmas weapons.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I like the style which it's in, and certainly it had some fun elements, such as the sequence where they're on a train, where Abed keeps trying to drag the journey out by adding different locations they got to go through, even though you can tell that Duncan is basically trying to move things along as quickly as possible.
He's always trying to steer them through the Cave of Forgotten Memories, which Abed tries to say, no, that's the Cave of Frozen Peas or whatever. Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, the fact that it's doing something different than the usual Christmas sort of special, I think, is certainly credible to it. It's also hard to compare Dan Harmon's writing for this show and obviously the more familiar writing for myself of Rick and Morty, as they're two very different beasts to me. Do you compare the two at all? Or?
They have things in common. Again, you definitely see this sort of a lot of the humor is referential humor. The one joke that I found myself chuckling the most over was that the meaning of Christmas is ultimately revealed to be the first season of Lost on DVD. Why? It's a metaphor representing lack of resolution. This joke comes up later where it's like, now I know what Christmas means. Thanks, Lost. You know, stuff like that. There's always this sort of level of like, you know, Dan Harmon stuff. All it's humor for pop culture obsessives. And, you know, I think any given episode of Community or Rick and Morty, you're going to get at least a half a dozen of these references. And as much as you're getting, you know, you're doing a stop motion animated episode of that's a reference right there and then. You know, on top of all the other stuff like the Christmas Wizard or the Christmas Pterodactyl with the holly wreath around its neck. It is, I think, maybe a bit. It's not. You know, it's not necessarily as altogether cynical as Rick and Morty is, but it is very much a sort of gallows humor. You know, this is, you know, the thing that kind of the underlying message of any sort of any sort of thing where you have a group of misfits together forming a group of friends, the theme almost always is that how these people are so alienated from other people that this is the only group of people that they could be friends with, you know, and many of these people, you know, are not outright likable. Jeff Winger, the Joel McHale character, is a jerk. You know, he's a jerk outright. So is Pierce. You know, and even the characters, the characters that you see yourself, you might see as being more sympathetic, like Annie or Abed. If you had to know these people in real life, you would probably have many encounters where you would just want to feed them into a wood chipper.
Yeah.
It's funny when you take it as a sitcom and it's presented in a sitcom format, then they're hilarious. But in a very, very, very real way, they're not always, I don't think, the most likable of characters, and that's something also that it has in common with Rick and Morty.
Yeah, it's, you see, I just view them as just so wildly different from each other. And while I can sit and watch Rick and Morty, just like episode after episode, I found this one more hardest to binge watch, and I don't know, I still can't place what it is. I mean, at the moment, Rick and Morty has obviously become the new hip show to hate upon, so I don't know why there's certain people out there who obviously adore this show and hate on Rick and Morty, so I don't know. I think I need to go back and watch more of it. I know that Certainly Chevy Chase isn't a fan of the show anymore. Nor Dan Harmon, as he publicly, those two had a public falling out. And it's an interesting issue mentioned already. I mean, just seeing who's actually part of the cast of Community and obviously what they've obviously gone on to do. Certainly, we got Ken Jeong, who obviously went on to do the Hangover movies. And I've lost my blood. No, I mean, Chevy Chase, I think, could have had a career after this, but I think he decided to go and shoot it dead with this.
Yeah.
But, I'm trying to think who went on to, who's doing the late show? Who plays Duncan?
Yeah. John Oliver, obviously. Alison Brie, obviously, is on Glow. Donald Glover, between his acting career and his rapping career, Childish Gambino.
Yeah. But I think in many ways, I actually prefer some of these actors when away from Community than I do in the show. I mean, have you seen the whole Community, or you just seen bits of it?
I've only seen bits here and there, and you know it's pretty much. I'm not going to say it's like this all the time, but this is. I'm not going to say this is like the archetypal episode for these characters, but this is pretty much how they usually are.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, for myself, I mean, I enjoyed it while it lasted. I wouldn't say it's my favorite Christmas special that we've covered so far, but it was certainly enjoyable while it lasted, and I appreciated what it was trying to do. And the animation.
Whether I think it might have, you know, if I were a bigger fan of the show or more well-versed in it, would I have been able to get more out of it? I think it's the bigger question, but, you know. I mean, for what it was, I certainly enjoyed it. Didn't have enough Ken Jeong in it, though. I mean, because my favorite part of any my favorite character in Community always was Senor Chang. So that he only had the one scene with the snowman, I was a bit disappointed.
Yes, definitely. But I mean, obviously, this was voted on by the folks over at the Last Angry Geek. Maybe they can shed some light onto why they loved it so much to vote for it. So.
Yeah, if you told me to review this episode, why?
So, let us know.
Yeah, let us know.
Forcing us to watch things of questionable nature. I mean, is there anything else you want to talk about this one? Or
I think I'm about communityed out.
We're going to take a quick break and perhaps send some questionable messages on the social media. When we return, though, we're going to be taking a journey to the world of Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
Oh, it's Christmas in the Playhouse, and our hearts are all aglow as we welcome you to the Playhouse and to Pee Wee's Christmas special. Oh, the holidays are here again. He's on earth, goodwill and cheer. As we wish you season's greetings at this special time of year.
Christmas! Hello, everybody! My name's Pee Wee! What's the
Back. You, of course, are still listening to TV Good Sleep Bad, your monthly trek through the dark regions of cool television. In the first half, we looked at Community Christmas Special. We're now going to look at another Christmas special, and that is for Pee-wee's Playhouse. A holiday special which I think many people sort of rank for its importance alongside the likes of the Star Wars Holiday Special, in the fact that since it was originally shown, it's continued to be one of those specials that is people just constantly want to revisit every year. And it certainly was the turn of ourselves this year, as we obviously ventured to made our first visit to Pee-wee's Playhouse. I mean, this was an episode which took place in season 3. If you're obviously not familiar with the character Pee-wee Herman, he is essentially a man-child played by Paul Reubens, and the show itself plays as kind of like a variety show with music and cartoons and skits. And in this particular episode, Pee-wee is hosting various people at the Playhouse, including numerous celebrity guests who we will get into. And his whole focus this episode is making sure Santa gets his list and trying to figure out what to do with a never-ending supply of fruitcake, which seems to be constantly bestowed upon him. But, I mean, Lucky, I mean, I believe that you're like myself in that you didn't have a huge grounding with the show Pee-wee's Playhouse. Am I right, Sam?
Pee-wee Herman. My recollection of Pee-wee Herman is that he started to show up on, you know, MTV has this sort of long and storied history of like introducing these sort of bizarre characters, and not necessarily always characters like as in fictional characters, but like all these sort of various figures and personalities in their ads. I seem to remember the first time, you know, it was ads for MTV that I first saw like a number of like people that went on to become big stand-up comics like Sam Kinison or Dennis Leary, or actors such as Pauly Shore, or people, I put people in parentheses and in quotes here, like Howard Stern, and just some of these other sort of, you know, people playing characters like Yahoo Serious or Randy of the Redwoods or Pee Wee Herman. So yeah, that he'd just show up in like MTV idents or whatever you would call them, that the, you know, in between the videos. And then he did the movie, he did the first movie, and then he did the show. And I think by the time, this is one of those things that I think the show, I think, started to get popular about the time. I'm looking at the vital stats on the show, and it premiered in September of 86 and ran till July of 91. And September of, I mean, 86 was the year I turned 13. The show debuted 3 months really to the day before I turned 13. And this is about, this show kind of became big about the time I was kind of growing out of shows like, I'd say shows like this, but I'm not sure there's really any way to kind of say shows like Pee-wee's Playhouse. I think the only other frame of reference I might have for comparison are like the Sid Marty Krofft stuff from the 70s, which were very, very much, you know, psychedelic. A different kind of surrealism, but it's still very surreal. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, the jokes about, you know, drugs on Sid and Marty Krofft shows. This I don't think is a drug show. This is just Paul Rubens is just going to do whatever the hell he's going to do, whatever comes into his brain. And as a sort of weird, it is a sort of this in this particular episode in particular is a very bizarre cross section of mid to late. This was broadcast in 88 of late 80s Americana, where you have, you know, people from where you have like rock and roll stars from the 50s. You have Frankie and Annette. You have the Del Rubio triplets, and then you have them up against like Oprah Winfrey, Joan Rivers, and then you have Katie Lang for some reason. Katie Lang putting in a performance, I would have thought she was on drugs when she did that. And I remember when Katie Lang first started getting popular, not too long before this, Katie Lang was like, oh, she's the new Patsy Cline. And it's like she's singing I think Jingle yeah. Bell Rock here. And it's just like she's barely keeping in key. And it's like, okay. You know, there's a lot of stuff in this episode that I don't know how well this holds up to future generations, because I honestly don't know how much, you know, you have to maybe how much you have to, you know, do you have to explain Katie Lang to someone who's younger? Do you have to explain Oprah Winfrey to somebody who's not from the United States? You know, stuff like that. I generally don't know. Like Oprah is an American thing. I don't know whether or not she's got any sort of international, you know, following or anybody outside. I mean, I used to be surprised that anybody outside Chicago knew who she was, because she got her start on AM television in Chicago. I remember watching her when I was like, you know, in single yeah. digits.
I think for myself, because I mean, obviously born in 83, so a lot of these special guest stars that they have in this, I was familiar with. Already, I mean, Oprah Winfrey, I knew as a talk show host. I mean, obviously, she's gone to become like one of the most powerful black women in America. But I would say that, yeah, I'd say it's certainly, if you're not a Xennial, if you're a millennial, I think that a lot of these people are going to be kind of lost on you as to who they are, or certainly their importance and why they would be featured on this. But I think I was sort of saying my generation is going to be sort of on the fringe of recognizing half the special guest stars of this episode. I mean, let's just obviously go through. I mean, this is obviously, let's not forget, I mean, this is a kids' TV special. But it is absolutely phenomenal, the guest stars that are on this particular special. I mean, you mentioned already we've got Katie Lang. We've got Cher. We've got Little Richard. The Del Rupo triplets, who I have no idea who they are, but they should not be wearing hot pants at their age.
The Del Rubio triplets were, they were, well, obviously they were a trio. You've seen the show, so you kind of, I don't have to tell you they were a musical yeah. trio, but they did that sort of, there was a sort of slight resurgence of 50s kitsch in the 80s, and they were they had been a singing trio in the 50s and the 60s. They didn't call themselves the Del Rubio triplets then, and they had not been active for a while, and then they came back and formed the Del Rubio triplets and did kind of like this sort of retro oldies type stuff.
Okay. I mean, we've also got Joan Rivers. What she's doing here, I have no idea. We've got Magic Johnson. Grace Jones, who is perhaps more bonkers than KD Lang. She, I mean, she's in full disco queen mode here, doing Little Drummer Boy.
Yeah.
I mean, she comes, she's basically turns up in a crate and released by Puri and just goes straight into her act. There's no introduction at all. She just goes into this random ass version of Little Drummer Boy, and it's like, okay.
And I want to point this out here. I want to point this out. Okay, Captain Van Buren from Law and Order misdelivered her to Pee Wee's Playhouse instead of the White House. Someone shipped Grace Jones to Ronald Reagan and Pee Wee got her instead.
Yeah, I mean,
don't explain. I can't even remotely explain that.
What's your feelings on Grace Jones? Because Grace Jones is kind of a weird crush for me.
I'm pro Grace Jones. I remember her from the time, kind of like late disco, early yeah. new wave era singer. You know, she covered the Police. She covered Joy Division. She'd do stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would say she was a crush, but for me, but you know, like I said, I'm pro Grace Jones, and I vote.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, I knew her originally from View to a Kill, where she's the henchwoman Mayday. And in the same film, mm-hmm. you see her lifting up then-boyfriend Dolph Lundgren. In uh-huh. one scene, he's just a random thug. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's she has an aura to her. She's nuts by no means. But
It's one of the kind of things that you keep seeing here, though, is that this is very kitschy. Yeah. All of these, and a lot of them, like I said, go back to sort of like the 50s thing here. Frankie and Annette. Dinah Shore. Little Richard. Charo. You know, Charo may be more 60s. Zsa Zsa Gabor may be more 60s. Joan Rivers, I think, if I recall at the time, in 88, Joan Rivers was the backup host for The Tonight Show when Johnny Carson didn't do it. It was flipping between her and Gary Shandling, but it was before Jay Leno became the official backup. She was one of the backup hosts. So people – and again, she was also a stand-up comedian in the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, I know her better for stand-up performances, which again makes it all the more surprising the fact she turns up here. I mean, obviously it's clean right. material she's working with here, but it's kind of charming to see these celebrity appearances as they turn up. I mean, Cher turns up, Whoopi Goldberg turns up random, and they're little snippets of appearances. But the fact that you've got a kids show and you can have guests of this caliber, because I mean, these are all people at the height of their careers that you've got appearing on this show. And I mean, the whole styling of the show, I mean, Paul Rubens basically based it on, like, the 1950s shows he grew up, so, like, Rockin' Bullwinkle, Mickey Mouse,
right.
Captain Kangaroo, and Howdy Doody. And you can certainly right. see that when you see how he commands it. Because, I mean, he wrote the show, he directed it, and he has such mm-hmm. command over the screen in all his mannerisms and movements. And there'd be simple scenes such as him opening the safe. Yet the way he does it is very much like Howard Lloyd or Buster Keaton. It's like a very solid silent right. screen presence. It's all about his body movements and that, and his vocal range in particular yep. is absolutely insane. It's like Bobcat Goldthwait in a Sunday suit.
And you mentioned the safe scene, and that was probably one of my top scenes of the special. The one where he's just doing the safe and then he looks over at the camera suspiciously because the camera's trying to find out the combo yeah. to the safe. I thought that was clever, very clever, kind of like a use of the medium that they're just words. The other, probably my absolute favorite bit was when he, you know, Dinah Shore calls and, you know, sings him, regales him with a performance of the 12 Days of Christmas. And he gets out a Pee Wee Herman doll and furtively sticks it up there. So she still thinks she's singing to him while he goes off. And she starts later on, we establish that she just starts adding. She goes well beyond the 12 Days of Christmas. And she's singing like 20 CD players and stuff like that. That I thought was clever. There were bits I felt that maybe were a bit too much, but just too much, I guess too much unrestrained id, you know, too many puppets, too many voices, too much kitsch, but this is not an adult show. This is not a show that's aimed at adults. It's aimed at kids. Although I suspect a lot of the stuff, the references were put in there would have been the parents would have understood. Again, going back to that Rocky and Bullwinkle level of humor, where you have the level of jokes that run to the kids, and then the slightly more sophisticated layer of jokes that run to the parents.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, just you obviously mentioned about the amount of characters in the show, and it is such a extensive cast of characters that are in this particular show. I mean, we open with like the brave fighting men of the Marine Corps choir who do the introduction, who turn out to also be the fabulous Marine Choir as they burst into the...
They are fabulous. Yes, they are very fabulous.
Well, we all know the greatest element of warfare is the element of surprise, and yes, the fabulous fighting men of the Marine Corps are certainly that, and you basically have this sequence. I mean, we obviously included at the start of this episode just because it's so funny how actually long it goes on. You can go off, make a cup of tea, and come back, and they're still introducing characters. And it's like
like the chair and the clock and the floor,
Jeffy,
and Randy and Terry,
the King of Cartoons,
and the King of Cartoons. By the way, King of Cartoons. Okay, I knew Lawrence Fishburne was on this show.
Yes, he's Larry Fishburne.
He shows up. He shows up. Cowboy Curtis shows up. Larry Fishburne, not surprised. Okay. Reba the Mail Woman. Okay. I knew that was S. Patha Murkison from Law and Order. Not surprised. It fucking shocked me that the King of Cartoons was goddamn Blackula. William Marshall.
Yeah. But then again.
He was Blackula. I'm like, that's fucking Blackula.
But then again, how much does Cowboy Curtis look like Superfly in a cowboy costume?
Oh, he looks exactly like Superfly in a cowboy costume. What the hell are you kidding? Good lord.
Jerry Kell he's got going on. Oh, I mean, the King... I love these characters. They're very one-shot. So, like, the King Cartoons turns up to show this random-ass cartoon from, like, I don't know when they made this thing, but basic.
It looks like a Fleischer Brothers joint. So, what I'm absolutely betting here, and not having seen any other Pee-wee stuff, is like I bet a lot of this stuff is like early like Fleischer Brothers stuff that was had recently just fallen into the public domain. They could use it for that, but it had a very pre Oob E-Works, very early pre like Disney type thing feel to it. I'm absolutely convinced it was Fleischer Brothers.
I mean, how did you find the cartoon? Because I mean, this is the cartoon where basically a hobo breaks into an orphanage and then plays Santa Claus by making toys out of random junk he finds around. So he turns like a set of umbrellas into a Christmas tree and makes like a train out of a percolator and a sled out of a radiator and All these creative use of the toys is very Wallace and Gromit in that respect.
I looked the cartoon up. It is called Christmas Comes But Once a Year. It is Fleischer Brothers. So I am a total and utter, cartoon nerd. I thought it was very charming. And imaginative, and that it's very kind of typical of the time, though. I like the bit where he's putting together the sled. He's, you know, assembling the sled, and he swallows some tacks and spits them out, you know, to nail them down instead of using a hammer. I liked it, but I like stuff like that. I like 20s and 30s animation. So it's the exact sort of thing that's going to kind of fit into my wheelhouse.
Yeah, and I mean, just obviously, again, just talking about surprising people who are involved in this show, Rob Zombie worked on the show as a production assistant. So,
yeah, I had heard that. The music was done by Van Dyke Parks, probably best known as Brian Wilson's collaborated when he started to go nuts.
Okay.
The guy who he co-wrote a lot of Smile and Pet
Right.
Sounds era Beach Boys stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's just looking here at the Wikipedia article, John Singleton had a cameo in one episode, not this one. You know, it's an interesting, I think, sort of slice of culture, of pop culture of the time. It's very, you know, it's very much of its time. It's about the only time, the last time you could have gotten away with, you know, putting Magic Johnson in a kid's show, because it wasn't too long afterwards he was diagnosed with HIV and, became more of a kind of like something that you really didn't, kind of something that was swept under the rug for a long time. You know, it's one of those things, but it's like, and I can definitely see where he would have been simpatico with Tim Burton, because Tim Burton has a lot of these same sort of aesthetic obsessions as well. The kitsch, the 50s type stuff. I don't think it, a lot of it to me, on the other hand, it was just, like I said, it was too much. It felt like it was trying too hard. Pee-wee Herman as a character himself, I think, is a bit of an acquired taste, because so much, he's very much of the interesting thing is that you had these 33 comedians come out of this sort of same era. Him, Bobcat Goldthwait, and Gilbert Gottfried, all of whom basically kind of made their name out of basically putting on abrasive voices. Pee-wee would go to various, I mean, he had about four or five different settings to his voice, and some of them really could get like nails on a chalkboard type annoying if he really kept them up for more than a sentence or two. It's just not something if I'd watched the show when it was out at the time, I would probably have a different reaction to it. But then again, you were telling me that this in the 80s.
We didn't. Pee-wee's Playhouse never made it over to UK as far as I'm aware. My only thing I knew about the character was through the films, so like the Tim Burton film, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and mainly through like references in like as a cult character, because obviously Pee-wee Herman is himself. He sort of grew out of the show and became this character of his own, and he did a number of PDSAs. I mean, Paul Rubens is so focused on how this character should be persuaded. I mean, be portrayed, because Paul Rubens himself is a heavy smoker, and he went out of his way to make sure that he was never photographed smoking or with a cigarette in his hands, because he'd never wanted the character of Pee-wee Herman to be anything other than a role model. So he was like constantly using it for the PDSAs, you know, on drug abuse and smoking, and trying to use it in characters good. And it's kind of interesting, because obviously when we look at Paul Rubens as a person, I mean, he's obviously busted for masturbating in an adult theatre in 1991. He's then arrested on pornography charges in 2002, And which I didn't obviously know about until we started researching for the show. And it turns out that he's actually a collector of retro pornography. And that he'd happened to have some stuff that was mixed in a bulk buy, that he was potentially going to be charged with child pornography charges. But because of the material, it wasn't, and how the reason he had it, it was actually dropped against him. But his, I think Rubin's just focused on this character and how he's created. I mean, I can understand what you're saying when you say it goes a bit too far in place. I think the hour runtime is a bit extravagant for this show. I think it could have been whittled down to 45 minutes. But I mean, I only saw this special for like the first time last year and was absolutely charmed by it. And I mean, it doesn't just cater to Christian Christmas. I mean, we have a Jewish portion, which it actually goes out of its way to go, hey, kids, this is the Jewish portion of the show. And we get to see Trader with a bouncing zombie head. Which I really thought was kind of charming. I mean, the dinosaurs who live in the wall were Jewish, and we see them celebrating Hanukkah, and it's going out of its way to subtly teach kids things in a way that modern kids shows don't have that sort of subtlety to do, which I kind of enjoyed. Right. And, you know, perhaps he gave me a fun new pet name for my wife by calling by naming her after the cat in the jazz band. And a chicky baby. I don't think she appreciated it much, but I just, when we're going for that list of characters, and it's like, chicky baby! And I mean, that's why I can't besmirch the K.D. Lang performing alongside the puppet jazz band. It just somehow works for me. But I think if you're of a certain age and you've got some sort of connection to the guest stars in this, or then you probably, if you've got that sort of sense of recognition for who these guest stars are, I think you will get a kick out of this. I think it's certainly got a retro charm to it. And just seeing Pee-wee set up his own sweatshop in the Playhouse is kind of fun to watch as well. Just the occasionally twisted moments, or him constantly being given fruitcakes. And yes, I agree. It's got moments which are perhaps a little childish to an adult audience like ourselves. But I mean, at the end of the day, this is a kid's show. But at the same time, you can still enjoy many elements like Billy Baloney, the really questionable ventriloquist puppet who decides to unplug the Christmas tree for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
But would you recommend this as a Christmas special if you were like looking for sort of kitsch Christmas specials to recommend, or was it sort of like a one and done?
I wouldn't stand on a street corner telling passersby, you gotta watch the Pee Wee Christmas special, it's so amazing. But yeah, it's like definitely I think it's something that people who have that sort of, you know, it's definitely there, I think, and it's definitely going to be appreciated for people who have that sort of aesthetic, you know. And they're really, you can really, if you want to kind of trace it, you know, I'm reading, you know, I know that this has been an influence on, say, like Steven Hillenburg, who created SpongeBob, or Steve Burns' Blue's Clues. And I kept thinking, for some reason, I kept thinking of Blue's Clues, even though Blue's Clues is so much more sedate. Blue's Clues is really kind of like a stoner show. It's just so laid back. Now we're going to go to our thinking spot. And, but it's, this is the sort of thing, it's like, yeah, I think there's definitely an audience that's still going to be out there for this. I don't necessarily know how wide that audience is, but hey, you know, different strokes, different folks. Not really my thing, though.
That's fine.
But hey, I'm glad I watched it.
For some reason, I now want to go off and watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood as well.
Oh, yeah, that's
apparently
really
sedate. Apparently he was an assassin for the CIA as well. So there's a random piece of random driven for you. But yeah, I mean, I think that's about all I have to really say about Pee Wee's Playhouse. I mean, definitely check it out. I mean, you can watch it. You can find it on YouTube and wherever you find videos.
It's on Netflix. In the United States, it's all on Netflix.
The actual copy I had still had the original adverts of the period it was recorded. So seeing like advertisements for Isotona gloves or very phallic adverts for Orbit gum and that awful toothpaste that was shaped like a star because no one thought how the hell you're going to squeeze it out. But
that must have been a British thing because I don't remember that. I remember Isotona gloves and I remember actually Orbit gum still is a thing.
These are all American adverts.
That's the one. That the one? That's the one with the slightly ever so slightly naughty British stewardess, their hostess.
Oh no, this
right?
is the one
for a clean.
This is the one where they're on the beach, and they're really excited the fact that they get cinnamon gum.
Wow. okay. Well,
but one of the adverts was also advertising Land Before Time. Remember that when that was a thing?
Yeah, there you go, Land Before Time.
That sort of brings us to the end of this Christmas special, and certainly another two random Christmas specials. But looking forward to 2018. I mean, what do you want to kick the new year off with, Lucky?
Danger 5, a show which I stumbled upon. It's not on Netflix US anymore, but a show. If you haven't heard of Danger 5, just kind of imagine that. Gerry Anderson kept making live-action TV shows today in Australia for some reason. And we're looking – Danger 5 is a farce that takes place during World War II. And the episode we'll be looking at is, and I am not making this up, Lizard Soldiers of the Third Reich.
Yeah.
So if we didn't get enough stop-motion animation in this episode, kids, we're getting some more next month.
Yeah, Danger 5 is certainly a unique concept, certainly one that appeals to anyone who's into sort of like 1950s boo movies or 70s cult cinema. And it really sort of meant that there was only one show that I could think to really pair it with. So for my selection, we're going to look at the pilot episode of Garth Marenghi's Dark Place with the very first episode, Once Upon a Beginning. This is a show which is shot like a spoof of an 80s horror show that was cancelled, mainly because if we're to believe its creators, it was too dark. And it takes place in this hospital called Dark Place Hospital, where you have Garth Marenghi, the creator of this series, plays Dr. Douglas, who always carries a gun and tries to solve supernatural mysteries that take place in the hospital. This has got some very well-known British comedic actors. I mean, this was known at the time. I mean, it gave us the first appearance of Richard Alioldi. Stephen Merchant turns up in an episode. Matt Berry's in there, as well as Matthew Holness and Alice Lowe. So there's a lot of people who would be very familiar, especially if you're a fan of, like, the crowd and Snuffbox.
That's right. I had forgotten Stephen Merchant was on this show.
Yeah, he plays the chief.
Yep.
I'm looking forward to revisit it and certainly see if it holds up as well as my nostalgic memories of it. Certainly think it does. But that brings us to the end of another festive special. Thank you everyone for listening as always. If people want to find you, Lucky, where's the best place to go and find you?
LuckyOnFilm.com.
As for myself, you can find my writings at From the Depths of the Hell, which is fromthedepthsofthehell.blogspot.co.uk. I'm also over at thatmomentin.com as well, writing game reviews and continuing my trek through movie locations in my ongoing series, The Movie Tourist, as well. But until next time, thank you as always to my co-host Lucky for braving another Christmas.
Yes, braving another Christmas.
And we look forward to certainly more randomness in 2018 as we continue these treks into the darker recesses. of Cool TV. And thank you all for listening. And as I said, we'll see you all in the new year.